Good evening. Welcome to the winter semester 2003 of the Michigan Writers Series. We're delighted you can be here on such a cold evening. This is the first event of our series for this semester. We have a flyer for the other folks coming to town, including Deanne London, Lisa Litzenberger, a student writer's night, and finally, in April, Stuart Dybeck from Western Michigan University. So please come to any and all of these events as you can make it. We're delighted that Bonnie Jo Campbell is here tonight with us to read. Thank you. Bonnie Jo Campbell grew up on a small Michigan farm in a house her grandfather, Herlihy, built in the shape of an H. She learned to castrate small pigs, milk Jersey cows, and make chocolate candy. When she left home for the University of Chicago, her mother rented out her room. She has since hitchhiked across the U.S. and Canada, scaled the Swiss Alps on her bicycle, and traveled with the circus. She has led adventure tours in Russia, the Baltics, and throughout Eastern Europe. After earning a master's degree in mathematics in 1992, she started writing fiction. She received her MFA in writing from Western Michigan University and lives in Kalamazoo. And I think your MFA was done under Stuart Dybeck, right?
With Jamie Gordon and Stuart Dybeck.
Jamie Gordon and Stuart, yeah. Stuart Dybeck, yeah. Jamie Gordon has appeared here as well, by the way. Bonnie Jo Campbell's collection of stories set in Michigan, Women and Other Animals, won the AWP Short Fiction Award and is now out in paperback. Her story, The Smallest Man in the World, was awarded a Pushcart Prize, and her new novel, Q Road, has been named a Barnes & Noble Discover Great New Writers book. The New York Times has called her stories bitter but sweetened by humor, and Publishers Weekly said Campbell details domestic worlds where Martha Stewart would fear to tread. Please join me in welcoming Bonnie Jo Campbell.
Thank you. Oh, I hear myself loud and clear here. Hey, were any of you guys at the LCC reading recently? Good, because I think I'm going to read the story that I read there, and I thought, gosh, if you guys had been there, I'd have to change my whole plan. Just to get us warmed up, I'm going to read two one-page stories. And after the reading, if any of you want to ask questions about one-page stories, why and where and how and all that, I'll be happy to answer. The first one is called Sleepover. Oh, and I'll give you a clue. One of these just won a prestigious contest. You have to guess afterwards which one. Sleepover. Ed and I were making out by candlelight on the couch. Pammy was in my bedroom with Ed's brother. She wanted to be in the dark because her face was broke out. We were wishing your head could be on Pammy's body, Ed said. You two together would make the perfect girl. I took it as a compliment. Unlike Pammy, I was flat-chested. Ed kissed my mouth, my throat, my collarbone. He pressed his pelvis into mine. The full moon over the driveway reminded me of a single headlamp or a giant eyeball. Ed's tongue was in my ear when Mom's car lights hit the picture window. Ed slid to the floor and whistled for his brother, who crawled from the bedroom on hands and knees. They scurried out the screen door into the backyard and hopped the fence. Pammy and I fixed our clothes and hurriedly dealt a hand of Michigan rummy by candlelight. You girls are going to ruin your eyes, Mom said, switching on the table lamp. When Mom went to change her clothes, Pammy whispered that she'd let Ed's brother go into her pants. Her hair was messed up, so I smoothed it behind her ear. Too bad this isn't in color, Pammy said later while we were watching Frankenstein. While the doctor was still cobbling together body parts, Pammy fell asleep with her small, pretty feet on my lap. I stayed awake, though, and saw the men from the town band together to kill the monster. Okay, the second one's called Night Train. The 4 a.m. whistle is a Conrail train traveling from Toledo to Chicago, probably pulling tankers of chemicals, maybe some open cars filled with scrap metal. My husband Roger hauls livestock south of here tonight, deep in Ohio. 3 months ago, Roger killed teenage brothers. Roger says the boys had the dome light on in a new Ford Ranger, and they appeared to be arguing as he approached, as he braked and blew the whistle nonstop. Every engineer has killed folks, Roger says. It's part of the job. Afterwards, Grand Trunk gave Roger a week off paid, and that's how we got our vinyl siding on with my dad coming over to help. Our house is all fixed up now, and my job will let me go to part-time when I get pregnant. Roger says you're driving the train, and up ahead some drunk asshole or some stupid idiot is stalled on the tracks, and you shout for the dumb son of a bitch to get out, grab his kids, and run. Women always jump out and run, but sometimes a guy will keep turning the key in the ignition. Keep pumping the gas. When you're driving the train, Roger says, you feel small like nothing inside tons of metal. When you're headed straight toward a station wagon or a minivan or a truck, all you can do is hope like hell. You blow your whistle and keep blowing, and you look away and you wait for the bump. So those are the little short ones. You can do a lot, surprising amount with a very short space. Those stories are both under 250 words. And there's a contest that traditionally was for stories under 250 words. And I just found out they changed it now to 500 words. And I'm a little disappointed because then it makes it a little more like every other contest. You know, it's kind of nice to have a real challenge to really put something into a very short story. I'm going to read a little section of my novel where I just put the marker in the wrong page. Okay, there it is. The novel takes place in Southwest Michigan, and it takes place in the present time, but the people in the story keep hearkening back to the past. And because I've read the first chapter of this so many times, I want to read another chapter from it, a chapter that takes place in the 1930s. The main character is George Harland, who's a sixth-generation farmer who's sort of threatened. His farm right now is threatened. And so he constantly refers back to his grandparents, Harold and Henrietta Harland. And I think the only thing you need to know for this to make sense is that there was a school teacher who came from Boston. It was pretty common in this part of the country for teachers to come from the East, even as late as the 1930s. And especially in real small, real rural areas where they just would still have a one-room schoolhouse. And so she the school teacher made some trouble because she was kind of a wild girl, and she was kind of sleeping with somebody she wasn't supposed to be sleeping with. So usually I read the title. I can say 31 because of chapter 31. The railroad tracks running alongside the Kalamazoo River have long been part of the train line between Detroit and Chicago. And 60 years ago, tramps and hobos came by the Greenland farmhouses and asked for food. Those men and the odd woman rode the rails or walked across the land and knew its shapes instinctively or by memory or anecdote and didn't care whose fields they crossed or slept upon, but traveled to satisfy a need not unlike belly hunger, to feel mile after mile pass beneath their feet. Perhaps such a traveler stole a chicken or caught a rabbit to roast over a campfire, or else picked a few ears of a farmer's soft young field corn. George's grandmother, Henrietta, as a young woman, was reservedly sympathetic to these lost creatures of God for their not being more firmly planted. But she feared that if she gave them food, they'd have some way of marking the road or the house to say as much. And so she fed them only after they'd done some work. In the early summers of her marriage, she kept certain jobs unfinished in order to have work to offer such men. She might have asked a man to mow her front and back yards with the hand mower, to sweep out a shed or shovel manure from a barn. Sometimes a man went away angry at the suggestion of work. Other times, Henrietta had difficulty getting rid of a fellow who said he wanted to stay and become a hired hand. Even back then, Henrietta had always made certain her barns were locked on nights when such transients were about, for fear of their carelessly starting fires. The speed with which the October 9th fire devoured George's oldest barn would not have surprised Henrietta Harland, not after she had watched the barn behind her own house go up like so many cigarette papers. She would, however, have been shocked at the speed with which a home could now be erected atop a poured concrete foundation by the importation on two trucks from Indiana of a prefabricated structure, the halves of which were lifted by cranes onto that foundation bolted in a few hours to the base and further secured with pneumatic nail guns and caulk tubes of adhesive. A Potawatomi wigwam of sticks and skins could hardly have been constructed more rapidly than one of these modern homes equipped with luxuries such as central air conditioning, wall-to-wall padded carpeting, and double-pane thermal windows. In autumn of any year of her adult life, before or after her husband's foolishness cost her family their oldest barn, George's grandmother would have been canning tomatoes and squash. She would have guessed accurately when the first hard freeze was coming, and on that evening, she would have gone out into the field and picked well into darkness, perhaps not really even noticing the darkness, since her eyes would have adjusted gradually to the dimming light. Using her fine natural night vision, George's grandmother would have picked even the greenest tomatoes and placed them on the back porch table. During the days, the tomatoes would ripen in what sun they could capture, and at night, Henrietta laid an old sheet or tablecloth over them to protect against freezing. Henrietta not only preserved for each winter, but planned further ahead to future generations. Like her mother before her, Henrietta planted walnut trees, several dozen a year at least, as gifts to her descendants. She knew that in hard times, a walnut tree could give food, furniture, and at the very least, excellent firewood. She sprouted them in her garden and transplanted seedlings to the windbreaks and to the edges of woods and the roadside, wherever the men did not farm. Like so many women of her generation, she had some children, and she hoped that some of them would stay and help her on the farm. And she did not often wonder if she had chosen the right life's work for herself. Women such as George's grandmother knew perfectly well that men had married them for their farms, and Henrietta had intended to choose for her husband the man who would best care for these acres. But instead, she fell for the most foolish man in Greenland, and then she had gotten pregnant one of those nights in the barn with him and was thus forced to marry the man she loved. For the first decades of her marriage, she tried not to remind Harold too often that she knew a great deal more than he did about a great many things. But after he burned down that barn, she could no longer forgive her own stupidity. Henrietta had not always been a hard woman, but in the last 30 years of her life, she found herself growing hard in response to her husband growing soft. After the barn fire and the schoolteacher business, Harold was no longer willing to blame or condemn anybody. Henrietta worried that the man might lose this farm should he outlive her. A man gone soft would daydream until crops failed and would neglect to prepare for the following year. She knew that a person had to be tough to resist breaking up a place, to resist selling or dispersing land among siblings. Henrietta did not understand how her husband had come to defend everybody against an unkind word, as though he were Jesus Christ himself. While a woman might love Jesus well enough, only a naive girl would want to be married to him. For had he not advocated love of himself above all things, especially beyond love of one's property? And had he not demanded his disciples stand ready to abandon their land and riches and follow him? Henrietta felt that despite life's injustices, people needed to accept their places and live with what they had. In her mind, it made no sense to lament not going to college or not taking the train to visit Chicago. Life laid out your work for you like a set of clothing, and you could either put on the garments or go around naked until you found another suit that fit. But you wanted to hurry because you could not do much while naked, and no one was going to take you seriously. If you did not get to do everything you wanted, say if your husband died young, then at least you ought to live righteously and not flaunt your freedoms. Mary O'Kearsey should have known that in moments of weakness, every woman longed for a big, quiet fellow like Engstra. But if they had not sent her away, O'Kearsey would have gotten pregnant, and that was no kind of example to be setting as a teacher of children. What if those girls and boys in her charge grew up thinking they should steal together through the fields at night and into barns? What if they grew to adulthood with no mind for tending crops on the farms their families occupied? What if instead of buying new equipment for planting and harvesting, they spent their meager incomes on travel to Europe? What then would have been the justification for wrenching this land away from the savages a century ago? Henrietta could have grabbed that little O'Kearsey by the shoulders and shaken sense into her the way her mother must never have done. There were still hungry transients and homeless people in America on the day David Redeker burned George Harlan's barn, but they had become, for the most part, city people. When they felt restless, they did not set off along river trails or into freight yards, but collected returnable bottles and cans. They begged and recycled until they scraped together the money for bus tickets to get to homeless shelters and downtown missions in other cities. Those salesmen in this day and age were comfortable traveling door to door, offering vinyl siding and vacuum cleaners. Homeless folks knew that the people who lived in the country nowadays were suspicious of a traveling man who had nothing to sell. And most of those unsettled folks had themselves grown lazier, too lazy to trek into unpopulated areas. They were unskilled in the skinning and gutting of rabbits, unpracticed in the stealing and plucking of chickens. And they might have lost for good the knowledge and instinct about which parts of an animal were edible, or which unripe crops, or which mushrooms. So there's your historical perspective for the day. The novel Key Road really is about this piece of land. I don't know how I ended up writing a story about a piece of land, but just it never stopped coming. Yeah. Yeah, between Comstock and Galesburg is where I envisioned this. I'm going to read a story now from this collection. This is just a kind of fairly long story that I'm going to read. It's called The Perfect Lawn. If I'm doing funny gymnastic things, it's because my karate teacher made me do like 150 push-ups yesterday, and I can't hardly move now. I don't know. What, really? Yeah, I gotta do something. And, you know, I found that I had to, you know, have my husband help me with my bra and stuff, you know, so. Okay, this story's called The Perfect Lawn. From his hiding place in the backyard, Kevin could see into Madeline's bedroom window and into a basement living room with sliding glass doors. On the other side of her ruffled curtains, the beautiful Madeline lay with a science textbook propped on her knees. As usual, Mrs. Martin spent the evening on the couch with a paperback close to her face and the television glowing. She smoked nonstop, pressing a cigarette to her mouth and pulling it away as regular as a heartbeat. Several times this school year, Kevin had seen Madeline storm into the living room and stand before her mother, hands on hips, as if demanding an explanation or dishing out discipline, as though Madeline was the mother and Mrs. Martin was the daughter. Madeline stood and pulled her off her Red Devil sweatshirt to reveal a thick white bra. Kevin inhaled and held his breath, but Madeline undressed no further. She stepped into the hall and the bathroom light came on. Through the frosted glass, he could distinguish no shapes. He let out his breath, moved up the lawn closer to the house near the burn barrel, and lay on his belly in the dry leaves. The Martin's backyard was not just neglected, it was a travesty. Under the newly fallen leaves, there were growths of moss, bare patches, and last year's decaying leaves and sticks. Kevin worked with his dad in the lawn care service when he wasn't in school, and he knew that with regular care, this yard could be as nice as any in the township. The property abutted the neighbor's woods all the way down to the river, which afforded many landscaping options for this scraggly border in which he took cover. Kevin would suggest right off yanking these pricker bushes and planting some medium-sized shrubs, something that would flower in the spring, forsythia maybe, and a couple of burning bushes for fall color. The other cheerleaders lived near the school in white-columned houses with manicured flower beds, or in the half-bricked ranch-style homes on Tiger Lake, whose yards sloped toward little boathouses and docks. Though Madeline had every right to live on Tiger Lake and to have the best possible lawn, she and her mom lived instead in this small asbestos-shingled house on the river, not far from Kevin. The night was unseasonably warm for November, so when Mrs. Martin got up from the couch and stepped outside with a grocery bag of trash, she didn't bother closing the sliding door behind her. She floated across the lawn, squinting against the smoke from the cigarette in her mouth, ashes and bits of paper falling away from her. Kevin flattened his body against the ground and cursed himself for choosing the new hiding spot. Mrs. Martin emptied the papers into the burn barrel and then held her disposable lighter inside until something ignited. The fire gradually lighted her face, neck, and chest. Her robe was fastened loosely, and Kevin wondered if it might slip open. Smoke spilled from her nose and mouth. Kevin's dad smoked too, but he burned cigarettes right down to their butts, then smashed them out in big glass ashtrays, bending and twisting the filters. He exhaled smoke in long, straight streams while Mrs. Martin just let the smoke drift out of her. Up close, Kevin could see that Mrs. Martin looked sort of like Madeline, or at least she had the same long reddish hair. Perhaps after Kevin and Madeline had gone together a while, her mom and his dad would start dating. It gave Kevin a moment of relief to imagine the four playing cards or eating a Thanksgiving turkey. But Mrs. Martin was staring into the barrel as though conjuring a vision or reading a message from the dark side in the flames. Through the eye-sized air holes punched in the drum, Kevin watched the fire gaining fury. She obviously wasn't wearing anything under that thin robe, not even a bra. She was standing too close over the fire, and he worried that her collar or the hair hanging in her face would ignite. He could almost see individual strands singe and shrivel toward her face. Mrs. Martin took a step back and crossed her arms, holding her cigarette right in front of her face so she could drag on it without effort. Kevin could not see what was burning, but from the smells, he imagined inserts from newspapers, a cereal box with a wax paper liner, a box of macaroni shells with a plastic window. Kevin didn't know what Madeline ate besides the pizza slices she carried away from the lunch line. Perhaps it was the thought of Madeline eating with her hands, or maybe he had been absent-mindedly pushing himself into the ground. Whatever the reason, Kevin felt himself erect against the grass and leaves. He looked toward Madeline's window, but Mrs. Martin was blocking his view. He contemplated scurrying away or else reaching under his body to adjust his personal part, despite the risk that Mrs. Martin might notice him. He could bring himself to do neither, and his whole body stiffened with indecision. Then, with a tiny crackle, a piece of flaming something popped out of the barrel through one of the air holes and landed 2 feet away. Within minutes, Kevin smelled leaves smoldering. Mrs. Martin continued to gaze into the barrel, not noticing the new fire. Her nipple pushed against the fabric of her robe. More leaves and some of the damp sticks began to smoke. Mrs. Martin's orange-lit face grew demonic in the rippling light. Her pale eyes shone wet, and the long shadows of her eyelashes reflected upward onto her forehead. She was some sort of thoughtless witch, unconcerned with what spells she was casting. Her snake-like fingers wrapped around each other and around her cigarette like an unholy tangling of limbs. He tried to remember Madeline's fingers. Certainly they were more respectable than this. The smoldering circle grew to the size of a fried egg. He knew the longer he delayed, the worse it would be to reveal himself in all his tompeepery. The smoldering orange-edged patch grew to the size of a small hubcap, but he would burn to death in silence rather than have Mrs. Martin tell his father that she'd found him skulking in her shrub bed. He pressed his groin into the lawn rhythmically. When Mrs. Martin finished her cigarette, she lit another from it and dropped the stub into the flames. She turned and headed toward the house, dragging her robe across the overgrown lawn, catching a stick and a couple of leaves in her hem. As soon as she slid the door shut behind her, Kevin stood and stomped out the smoking debris, breaking up the pile to make sure nothing was still burning. Then he collapsed on the ground, telling himself that if this fire had been let go, the woods next door could have caught. If Kevin had not been here watching, that big tree by the house eventually might have fallen in flames through Madeline's roof, pinning her in her bed. Kevin imagined the beautiful Madeline curled safely in the dark, under blankets, wearing red cheerleader underpants and her bra. One January afternoon, Madeline approached Kevin at school and stood with her arms crossed over those lush breasts, big and smooth, like a couple of knolls built up for decorative annual plantings. Because there was a game tonight, she wore her cheerleader uniform. "I'm sick of you following me," she said. "Huh?" She was so close that Kevin smelled her powdery perfume. I purposely went out to the parking lot and then back to the gym so I could see for sure, and you definitely followed me. Madeline turned her face up and shook her hair against the cream-colored backdrop of the painted cinder block hallway. She pushed her hand through her hair front to back, pulling strands away from her face, giving the impression that possessing such a mane was a noble burden. Kevin never tired of this performance, and he couldn't help it that hair as thick and long as Madeline's gave a guy the idea he'd like to have her head in his lap. Kevin's surveillance of Madeline Martin, however, had nothing to do with thoughts of initiating her into personal acts he might have seen in magazines his dad subscribed to. The Burn Barrel fire had made Kevin aware that danger was always present and that he must continue to protect Madeline. He meant to come clean with her now, but he didn't know where to start. Instead, he stared at her chest. "And stop staring at my tits," said Madeline. "That is so rude." "Sorry," he said. His eyes traveled down to her pleated skirt, red and yellow, barely long enough. She would reveal the underpants during athletic maneuvers at tonight's game. Many of his male classmates seemed to prefer the petite figure of Brianna Harding, head cheerleader and homecoming queen. But Kevin had studied them side by side, and Brianna's overmade face and blonde hair looked as dull as a plastic mannequin's next to Madeline's natural glow. Little Brianna might posture on the top of the pyramid with ease, but only because at the bottom and center of the pile, with feet secure on the asphalt track or gymnasium floor, there was someone as solid as Madeline. "If I catch you following me again, I'll tell the vice principal." Her hands were propped on her hips, and she looked him square in the face. Madeline was a forthright girl, no doubt about it, but her eyes were as cool green as the perfect lawn. "I won't follow you anymore," Kevin said, letting his vision fall farther toward her muscular legs and shapely feet. "Good." She pivoted and walked away, her calf muscles clenching with each step, her thighs rubbing against one another, her hips swaying side to side, shifting her pleats so they flash red, yellow, like one of those plastic outdoor pinwheels. Kevin was a man of his word, and not following her would probably be for the best, since he could stop being late to his classes. He might even graduate on time in May if he kept handing in his partially completed homework and didn't accumulate any more tardies. Attendance, rather than achievement, had always been his strong suit. He hadn't made any promises about watching Madeline's house, of course, and to protect himself from the elements on cold winter evenings when his dad was at the pub or sleeping, Kevin wore his dad's Carhartt coveralls with the snap-on hood. A piece of landscaping plastic kept him dry. Once he stuck one of his dad's business cards in their front door, but Mrs. Martin never called. By following her in his dad's truck one morning, Kevin discovered that she worked at the plastic molding factory, which meant that she probably couldn't afford a lawn service. The next time the snow melted, Kevin lugged a 50-pound bag of lime through the woods, and by the light of a dull half moon, he spread the grit over their half-frozen lawn. Lime dissolved slowly and would help bring the acidity in line by midsummer. The second fire started in the living room. Despite the cold, Kevin had fallen asleep near the pricker bushes, and when he awoke, both bedroom lights were off and the downstairs was only dimly lit by the clock on the television. Something seemed odd inside, flickering and dimming. He walked to the sliding glass door, through which he saw thin streams of smoke. One tongue of flame rose from the couch, then disappeared. Another jabbed upward from the other side of the same cushion. Kevin yanked open the glass door and took the carpeted stairs two at a time, then entered the first bedroom, which he knew to be Madeline's. He ran to her bed, pushed his arms under her, intending to scoop her up and carry her to safety. It had never occurred to Kevin that the beautiful Madeline would be heavy, heavier than him, and that she would scream and slap and punch him. "Hey, stop it, you, stop it." She continued to hit Kevin as he tried to work his arms out from underneath her. When he yanked himself free, Madeline toppled to the floor beside him. She grabbed her alarm clock and struck him in the head, momentarily stunning him. K- Kevin held up his hands to protect himself from a second blow. There's a fire, Madeline. I thought you had smoke absorption. Kevin had to admit, though, that there was only a hint of smoke in the air. Who is that? Demanded Madeline. I know that voice. She fumbled and switched on her ruffle-shaded bedside lamp. Oh, my God, it's you, Kevin, you gross thing. Get out of my bedroom now. She stood and brushed off her T-shirt and pink and white boxer shorts as Kevin backed toward the hall, his eyes shocked by the light. Kevin would never see boxer shorts in the same way again. But there's a fire, he said from the doorway. He had her attention. Downstairs, he said. He pushed his Carhartt hood off his head. I think your couch is on fire. Madeline sniffed. Oh, shit. Damn you, Mom, she shouted toward the wall. Madeline pushed past Kevin, and he followed her down the stairs and into the living room. Flames shot up intermittently from the cushions, and the air stank of burning foam rubber. We've got to drag it outside, she said. She lifted one end of the couch, apparently without effort. Kevin lifted the other and pretended that he, too, found it effortless. Cigarette burns encrusted the couch arm. Kevin's eyes watered from the smoke, which had started to pour out of the cushions. Once outside, Madeline pitched the cushions into the snow. Kevin could see through the clear patches of ice that crabgrass grew around the cracks in the cement. Shouldn't we put water on it? He said. He felt odd about leaving the couch to smolder in the darkness, but he followed Madeline back inside. Kevin was warm in the coverall, which was a little too big around the middle and too short in the legs, but Madeline's arms were covered with bumps, and the hair on them stood straight out. He willed himself not to look at her breasts. It won't do any good to pour water on it, said Madeline. That padding burns for days. Nothing you can do. Believe me, I know. And she threw back her head, shook her hair, and yelled up the stairs. Damn you, Mom! Kevin considered sharing his secret about the burn barrel fire, but it would mean letting on about watching her house. He looked up to see the smoke pooling at the ceiling. What the hell are you doing here anyway? She said. I just happened to be passing by. Kevin choked out a cough he'd been holding in. Through my backyard? You know I don't want you following me. I live farther down the river, Kevin said. This is a shortcut. Well, you shouldn't be shortcutting through people's yards. She ran a hand through her smoke-permeated hair. I think you should leave now. Just then, Mrs. Martin drifted into the stairway and turned to face Kevin with only one eye open. Her bathrobe hung so that her left breast was half visible. Kevin was struck by its softness as compared with the firmness of Madeline's breasts. What is it, Madeline? She said sweetly, oblivious to the smoke. You just about burned the place down again, Mom, that's all. Where's our couch? Mrs. Martin reached into her left-hand pocket and pulled a cigarette gently out of a pack. Mom, you aren't listening. The couch was on fire from one of your stupid cigarettes. Mrs. Martin's other eye finally opened, and it was bloodshot. Her hair lay flat on one side of her head. She supported herself by the stairway railing. How much did you drink tonight anyway, Mom? Is this one of your boyfriends, dear? Oh, God, Madeline rolled her eyes. Look at him, Mom. He is not one of my boyfriends. This is retardo Kevin. What's that name? Mrs. Martin's eye threatened to close again. Just Kevin, ma'am, he said. Oh, hello, Kevin. Nice to meet you, ma'am. Kevin stuck out his hand and shook hers the way his father would shake a client's hand. She momentarily let go of the railing, but then took it up again. So did you two go out tonight? Mom, get it through your head. I do not go out with Kevin. Madeline crossed her arms and looked up at the ceiling, which made an attractive gesture, Kevin thought, like certain flowers turning to face the sun. Mrs. Martin lit her cigarette and let the match fall to the carpet. See, Mom, you're doing it again. Madeline stomped as though she might lose her temper. What did you just do with that match? Oh, don't worry, honey. I'll vacuum tomorrow, she said. Then to Kevin in slurred speech, she's embarrassed for you to see the house when it's such a mess. No, Mom, I am not embarrassed for Kevin the Freak to see our messy house. I just want you not to burn it down, that's all. Did you want a beer, Kevin? Asked Mrs. Martin. Kevin wasn't sure he heard correctly. He's not old enough to drink. He's in high school, Mom. You kids are so conservative these days. Mrs. Martin laughed, lighter than air. Kevin couldn't imagine why he thought she was an evil witch out by the burn barrel. As Madeline and her mom bickered, Kevin watched the ash on the woman's cigarette grow long and yet defy gravity. Mrs. Martin seemed so light that if she let go of the banister again, she might just float up. He felt an overwhelming desire to take care of Mrs. Martin, to get ashtrays for her, to check every hour whether or not her couch was on fire. He stared into Mrs. Martin's freckled chest. Mom, do yourself up, said Madeline tiredly. Kevin, stop looking at her chest. Madeline adjusted the front of her mother's robe and cinched it tightly across her stomach, causing Mrs. Martin to lose her balance momentarily. Kevin felt a terrific pity for the woman. It must be difficult, he thought, to have a daughter as awesome as Madeline. In May, Kevin and Madeline graduated together, but the beautiful Madeline walked with a football player, while Kevin walked with his cousin Crystal, who sniffed from allergies through the whole ceremony. After that, at least one afternoon a week, Kevin drove his father's mower along the shoulder of the road to the Martin house. He fertilized the lawn, spent hours dethatching and reseeding, and then he mowed it in straight lines. Having the river right there and the big trees at the side kept the grass lush without any watering. Mrs. Martin tried to pay him, but he would accept only supper and a beer. Kevin didn't like beer, but he figured he'd try to get used to it. Hi, weirdo, Madeline would say without even looking at him, and then she'd shake back her hair. I'm not hungry for dinner today, Mom. Mrs. Martin always asked Kevin what he wanted for dinner, and he'd say, oh, anything would be fine. She'd make herself and him a grilled cheese sandwich, a burger, or macaroni and cheese from a package. She'd sit across the table from him as though she were his mom. He wished she'd offer him milk, but she never did. She read books even while she ate, read more than anyone he knew. His dad only read newspapers on the backs of fertilizer packages to see how much water to add. You should meet my dad, said Kevin one day after the last bite of a cheese sandwich. Oh, is he a nice person like you? Oh, he's really nice. He has his own business, you know, and he's not married. Mrs. Martin looked up from her book, kept looking at Kevin while she tugged a cigarette from her pack and lit it. The inside of her mouth looked dark. Her skin looked pale in the kitchen light. Kevin blushed, though he didn't know why. He tried to make conversation. Do you like working at that plastics factory? Smoke poured out of her nose as she spoke. It's kind of like dying and going to hell 5 days a week. Beer went up Kevin's nose, and he coughed until his throat cleared. Mrs. Martin went back to reading, and Kevin looked out the kitchen window to where Madeline was finishing an entire bag of potato chips and sunning herself next to the driveway. She wore reflector glasses and a bikini cut so small and high over her hips that a person driving by could see almost every detail of her most personal body parts. Kevin excused himself and stepped out into the front yard. Why don't you lay in the backyard by the river, he said. The river stinks, she said. I don't go down there. She was right. The river did stink, but you got used to it. My dad and I used to fish in the river, Kevin said. He put his hands in his pockets before he started his own lawn business. My dad's an architect at a firm, said Madeline. Kevin couldn't see her eyes behind the glasses. He's designing a shopping mall in Grand Rapids right now. The way she said it made Grand Rapids sound truly grand. He lives outside Detroit with his wife. Do you like the way the lawn looks now? Asked Kevin. I'm leaving, so I don't care, Madeline said. I'm getting out of this hellhole, and I'm going to college in Ann Arbor. My dad is going to pay for what's left after my scholarship. The revelation struck Kevin like an alarm clock to the head. Of course she would go to college, and of course she had too many talents to go to the community college like other kids. You won't know anybody there, Kevin said. That's right, and nobody will know I come from this place. Mrs. Martin invited Kevin to Madeline's small going-away party in the third week of August. Madeline was a vision of loveliness in a red and white checkered miniskirt and matching halter top. Kevin hadn't thought an architect would look much different from a landscaper, but Mr. Martin turned out to be a tall, dark-haired, clean-shaven man with a distinct hairline. He looked to be of a different species altogether from Kevin's father. Kevin couldn't imagine Mr. Martin ever having been married to Mrs. Martin. Even now, Mr. Martin kept straightening his napkin and looking at Mrs. Martin as though she were overgrown limbs that someone needed to lop off and toss on the compost pile. Mrs. Martin had started out sober, but upon the arrival of Mr. Martin, went into the kitchen and poured herself a half vodka, half orange juice in a tall glass. She grew unsteady and her mouth frozen in a loopy smile as though it was made out of Play-Doh and stuck there on her face. Madeline didn't treat her mother with her usual impatience. Today, Madeline ignored her entirely and hung at her father's side. Mrs. Martin was going to be so alone without Madeline that Kevin felt like crying for her. He had to arrange a meeting soon between Mrs. Martin and his father. Perhaps they could speed up the dating process and get married right away. Madeline might take years to come around to Kevin, but Mrs. Martin seemed genuinely open-minded. After everyone waved goodbye to Madeline and Mr. Martin, who was driving her to Ann Arbor, Kevin ran home to find his father through the woods, through three other backyards, away from a German shepherd that chased him barking to the end of a 20-foot chain. When he got there, the truck was gone, so Kevin sprinted a half mile to the pub, where he found his dad at a table with Officer Harding and a guy in a postal uniform. "Hi, son," said his father. Kevin was too winded to speak right away. "This your kid, Sam?" asked the postal man. "Yep, this is Kevin. He's working with me full-time this summer." Kevin's dad clapped him on the back. After being outdoors in the sun, Kevin was blind in the dark bar, and he had to feel his way down into a captain's chair. The three men drank beer from draft glasses and expelled streams of smoke, tapping their cigarettes into a central glass ashtray. "Hey, Cheryl, bring my boy a Coke." "Diet or regular?" she shouted back across the room. "Hell, Cheryl, you think he's on a diet?" "Last time you brought him in here, he ordered diet." The men at the table glanced at Kevin, mildly alarmed. Kevin had finally caught his breath. "Regular, please." He had ordered diet last time because that's what Madeline drank. "Dad, I came over here because I wanted you to meet that lady I was telling you about." "Boy's trying to fix me up," explained his dad, tapping his cigarette again on the ashtray, "with a lady named Martin, his girlfriend's mother." "My daughter was in cheerleading with the Martin girl," said Officer Harding. "Same one?" "Yes, sir," said Kevin. "She's going to the University of Michigan." "Smart girl," said Officer Harding. "The mother's a little out there, though." "No, sir," said Kevin. "Oh, I picked her up once by the library," said Harding. "She's walking around in a bathrobe drunk. Robe was hanging all the way open, so I give her a ride home." He leaned back from the table and raised his eyebrows. "I can tell you boys one thing. That broad's a natural-born redhead." The three men laughed, and it took Kevin a moment to catch on. His dad crushed out his cigarette, mashing and extinguishing the hot ash. How could an officer of the law talk about Mrs. Martin's personal parts that way? Didn't they see she was a struggling mother? Kevin felt an urgent need to check on Mrs. Martin, to see if she was okay, to make sure nothing was burning. He sucked down his Coke and excused himself. He walked halfway and then broke into a jog. When he got a cramp, he walked again. Kevin entered through the back door and, out of habit, sniffed for smoke. He brought in some dirty paper cups from the picnic table and threw them away in the kitchen. A half-empty fifth of vodka sat on the counter. Kevin put the lid on the bottle, then climbed the stairs to Madeline's bedroom. Lace throw pillows and a ruffle-edged spread covered the bed. A scarf hung across her mirror, a scarf Madeline apparently could do without at college. The dresser top was arranged neatly with a jewelry box and a picture of herself in her cheerleader outfit. Her powdery smell lingered, but the room was only a shrine now. Kevin knew darn well Madeline wasn't coming back to these cracked plaster walls or to him. He sat on her bed, hands over his eyes, because he couldn't help himself. He'd started to cry. An arm slipped around his shoulder. It was Mrs. Martin sitting beside him on the bed. Her eyes were red and teary. Her hair fell limply around her face. She was the only one who would understand, the only one who loved Madeline the way he did. She wrapped a second arm around him, pulling him toward her as though she were an extensive lap upon which he could rest. To escape the stream of smoke from her cigarette, he let his face fall into her neck. She dropped the cigarette, still burning, onto Madeline's end table, and it rolled against a plastic framed picture of Madeline and her father. Then Mrs. Martin's long fingers began to snake around Kevin. They reached inside his shirt, undressing him, pulling him apart. His desire for Mrs. Martin hit him unexpectedly like an electric shock. She unzipped his jeans and he kicked them the rest of the way off. The softness of Mrs. Martin's breasts and skin made him want to swear allegiance to her, to say that he would protect her from fire and crabgrass and every other thing. But he was unable to form words or even to look into those eyes, not green like Madeline's, but orange. As Mrs. Martin opened her robe and laid her naked weight on him, Kevin struggled one last time to smell Madeline's perfume through the cigarette smoke and the scorching plastic of the picture frame. Long hair fell around his face and trailed in his mouth. Mrs. Martin's legs wrapped around him, and her body threatened to devour not just his personal part, but all the rest of him, too. Invisible flames curled around him, like a late summer heat that wilted flowers, singed grasses, and cracked bare earth. As his body combusted, he watched the backyard through the window glass and soothed his eyes upon the cool emerald expanse of the perfect lawn. So that was sort of a dirty story. So I am happy to answer some questions. Is that what I should do now? Okay.
I just wanted to ask you about the shorter stories.
Uh-huh.
Do you find that writing, do you limit your words before you set out to write, or is it something that happens as you're writing? And do you find writing short challenging, or is that easier for you than writing something long? How does that process work?
Yeah, every story is different, of course. And I do like setting challenges just to see if I can do it. I don't do it too often. Mostly I just write what I feel like writing. But I think it's good practice to see if you can work within parameters. Sometimes it's difficult to write stories just for the reason that it's too wide open. You know, you can write anything. You know, at least if you're writing an essay, you're limited to the actual world. But I mean, in fiction, all possible worlds are there at your fingertips. And so, you know, maybe it's fun to have some exercises where you really limit yourself. And I had wanted to, enter. I'd always admired the stories that won this contest. Mm-hmm. And so I had, you know, it was something that I wanted to try doing. And I also think it's really good to write these if you're a fiction writer, because a lot of times when there's an opportunity for you to read in public, like at a school function, a lot of times the poets will be the ones called upon to do it because they know they got some short stuff. And fiction writers, they a lot of times they'd never call on you to read something because they, you know, you've got 10-page stories and you can't read that at a you know, commencement or something. But if you've got these little short ones that kind of work like poems, then it can be really fun to read them at public events.
Were you reading at Way Station today versus doing anything else then?
I was just signing there, actually. Yeah.
And which story was the winner?
Oh, it was the body parts one. So, but I almost think that they would have picked the other. I think the other one was third.
The sleepover
was the first prize, and I think that because they give a first and second prize, and then they also asked if they could publish the train one. And I'm kind of part. I guess I like them both. I do. If you're thinking about writing these short shorts, I think it's good to, as the kernel of your short, to have some idea that you just know you've always wanted to write a story about, but it just never fit in any other story. Because the nice thing about these is, like, if you've got a really sort of intense little idea or message or image that you've always wanted to use, you know, but it just hasn't gelled with your other work, this is the perfect opportunity to let it be all about that little kernel. It's called the World's Best Short Story Contest. Yeah, they also have the same magazine has a poetry contest. Look up, if you want to look it up, it's under Florida Review, I think that's the name of the magazine.
Southwest.
That might be another one. Southwest Florida Review?
Yeah.
Okay.
The deadline
is February 15th or something,
So it's very soon. 500 words now.
I know, they changed it. I thought that was kind of crazy. I like these little short ones. The World's Best Short Story Contest. And if you put that into Google, you'll find, in quotes, it'll be the only place it'll come up.
Do they have a different judge each year?
Yeah, they do. They didn't used to. It used to be that guy,
It's Robert Butler this year.
Is it? Okay. I'm not sure if they...
The judge was last year.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I know that next year they're going to start flying the winner to Florida, but not me.
Did you get a bag of oranges?
I better get a bag of oranges.
I know.
I'm going to have to get on them because I'm just remembering I didn't get it.
So is it a bottle of beer?
Oh. Yeah. Make sure you guys stop up. You can stop up and look at my bottle of beer, but make sure you take a pack of matches because, who's the last writer who gave you a free gift? Pack of matches, advertising my book. No, the thing with writing a book is everything about it is hard. It's hard to write the book. It's hard to get the book published. It's hard to edit the book. It's hard to work with people on the cover of the book. I mean, everything about a book is so hard. And then, so you got to find as many fun distractions as you can. And so I just, at Bell's Brewery, I was sitting there, and my friend Peter's, I said, boy, wouldn't the cover of my book look good on a beer? And he said, I could do that for you. And actually, it was quite a long, drawn-out process. We had to get the label approved by the alcohol, tobacco, and firearms people, like 3 months in advance. So it was a big deal, but it is good beer. But it was really nice. They did it for, I had my book party at... What do you call it? Book release party at a brewery, so they made this beer for me. So,
I think some of the students here might be interested in knowing whether those are your ideas or your publicist's idea, what a publicist does. I mean, did you want to have matchbooks that you...
Yeah, I did.
That was your idea?
Yeah. As far as promoting the book, really, compared to... You guys know about the whole literary writing thing, right? That we're like way down below. Like the soup Nazi on Seinfeld, he's really famous, and we're way down. But he just appeared on one episode for like 10 minutes. And he's way more famous than Joyce Carol Oates, who's, maybe the most important novelist in America. And so, writers are pretty little. And so, especially a new writer like me doesn't get much attention from a publicist. And so the publicist, mainly their job is to set up readings, send out materials for you. But any of the weird stuff, you got to do yourself. Anything. And they were a little nervous about, Scribner was a little nervous about the beer. I think maybe they're owned by Disney, I don't know. But they were just a little nervous about the beer. And you better not send it to people. I was going to send it to all kind of people at Scribner, and no, you better not.
You should let them buy beer, just send them an advertisement.
Yeah, really, that's right.
Bell's the preferred though.
Yeah.
There's Peterson's and Sons Organic Vineyard outside of
mm-hmm.
Belsu,
yeah.
And they're one of 8 organic vineyards in the United States.
Wow, they have, my next
organic
book, I'll have to have a wine. The next...
Vineyard.
The next book I'll have to go wine because, I actually like to drink both beer and wine. So the hard liquor will take a little longer probably to get. That's a little more regulated. But yeah, for promoting a book, you really do have to do it. I think most people who you'll meet who have a book do quite a bit of promotion. I mean, there are people who just will let the book promote itself, and usually they have professor salaries. Or some other way of making a living where they're not hoping to write for a living like I am, naively.
Well, at least, so
I'm living right now off of money I earned from teaching. I just live very cheaply.
And did you?
I taught writing, yeah. I can teach, I actually like teaching mathematics. You know, I have this master's in mathematics, and I like teaching math, but I'm now that I have books and a little bit of fame, I get paid a lot more to teach writing. So, you know, if I tell you, teaching math is so much easier because you know when they're wrong, when you're correcting their paper, and they'll even believe you when you tell them they're wrong. But with writing, it's all the gray area.
What's your area of math?
Graph theory, which is, oh, great. Yeah, graph theory. My next book is all about graph theory. My next novel. We'll see if the American public can stand mathematics presented in my way. I might be taking a chance. But no, I as far as supporting, there aren't too many writers who can actually pull off supporting themselves just with books. Most writers do other things. A lot of writers teach. Some write, you get little dribs and drabs of money for going to conferences and for teaching workshops and stuff like that. But and I'm hoping to just keep writing. I'm hoping I can finish my next novel by the time the money runs out. That's what I'm hoping. And I get the health insurance from my darling husband.
Besides great expectations and unbrimmed talent, are you a member of the Michigan Writers Association? Or why is it Ray Welsh here? I mean, you think
I'd be asking to join. No, I'm not sure, actually. I know I'm interested to find out about the Midwestern. I'm not going to get the name right, am I? Midwestern Writer. The Society for the Study of Midwestern Literature. Yeah. Can't wait to find out about this. I want to belong to every society that'll have me as a member. Is there women writers? Yeah, I'll join them. I'll join them all. You know, I wouldn't even have to write at all. I could just go to meetings. I could just go to writing meetings.
Well, Duluth, Minnesota, University of Minnesota, they have a good summer program. Like, could you teach for a week?
Yeah, there are a lot of programs that are around the country that have little, you know, some are just weekend programs, but they do them weekends in a row, or some of them have, yeah, 1 week programs. Yeah, and I think as my money begins to disappear, then I'll be looking at these. So thank you for that tip.
There's one outside Chicago. I think it's called River Forest.
I'm gonna have to make you stay after. Okay. I know everybody. Make sure you get a pack of matches. And actually, my web address is on these matches. As well as my ISBN number. But if I mentioned anything that you wish I would have elaborated on or that you wanted to ask me but you were too shy, you can send me a note through my website. And it's a really cool website that my friend Rachel made, so I can't take credit for it. But it does have a naked man on it. It does have a, somebody told me my website is the only one that has full frontal male nudity on it, so. But check it out. Okay, it looks like no other questions. Thank you very much.